The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, we're rounding the bend on the end of March, which means many bleary-eyed sports fans are looking back at their brackets and wondering, where did I get it wrong? For basketball addicts, picking March Madness brackets is about loyalty and love of the game. And for others, it's gut. Still others, it's data. And that is the province of 538.com, which recently collaborated with Fictionless on a video comparing strategies. Neil Payne is with us from 538. Hi, Neil.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, and I just adored this video. Let's hear a clip. This is from the introduction of the video, Breaking the Bracket.
I'm Sam Holtz. I'm 13 years old. I live in Lake Zurich, Illinois, and they call me the Bracket Boy.
I'm Amanda Shears, I'm 47. I live in Berkshire in England, and I'm the top-ranked data scientist in the UK.
I'm Jimmy Vaccaro. I'm 70 years old. I've been in Las Vegas 41 years. I'm the odds maker for the South Point Hotel and Casino, and I'm damn good at it.
So what do these three have in common?
So the thing that all three had in common was that they were pretty successful at picking the NCAA tournament brackets last year.
So let's talk about the difference in their approaches. Sam Holtz, the 13-year-old from Illinois, how'd he do it?
So it seemed like Sam used kind of gut instinct as his basic algorithm, if you could call it that. He said he picked on teams that he liked, that he had seen play. Obviously, he didn't have time, you know, as a high school student, didn't have time to watch obsessively and see every single game. So he probably caught a few games during the conference tournaments and throughout the year, and he kind of formed his opinion based on that and some things that he had, like, read or heard or around the internet and on TV. So that's kind of the gut feel approach of picking teams.
I admit I kind of fell in love with Amanda Shears, the data scientist.
Oh, yes.
She knew nothing about college ball. How did she even find out about March Madness?
I think it was part of a contest that they have. You know, they have these machine learning contests where data scientists like Amanda go and they try to just are given data. It doesn't even matter what the topic is. I think her main data research, purview was about cancer research and trying to kind of take all of this medical data and predict the effectiveness of a drug at treating cancer. But in order to kind of practice, they'll use sports data often in these competitions. And so she got into it that way, and she is using these very powerful algorithms and machine learning techniques. She did that, and it ended up working out very well for her.
It's so funny. She says, I didn't know Kentucky had a team. I thought that's where we got our chicken.
Yeah, she was definitely a great character in that video.
But what was she actually looking for?
So, I mean, she's looking, and in fact, all of them are looking for what is the best predictor. And one of the best ways to figure that out is to look at what were the best predictors in the past, which factors were. And in Amanda's case, it was about, you know, looking at which specific stats about each team correlated best to having it do well in the tournament. And so she found a particular algorithm that when you took each team's sort of relevant data points and plugged them in to her formula could give you better predictions about who would win when the teams played in March.
So three-pointers, fouls, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, trying to figure out characteristics of winning teams, basically.
But it's not straight data in Vegas. So what do Jimmy and his cohort bring to this?
So Vegas almost has the best of all possible worlds because they definitely use data models, and he talks about it in the video also of, like, you come up with a power rating for each team, and it represents the intrinsic ability of the team. And so that's how they kind of set their opening lines on the tournament games. But then people start to actually bet, and they vote on how accurate your predictions were with their dollars. And Vegas is able to tweak up and down their lines that they set for each game based on how people are voting. So they're using what's called the wisdom of the crowds, in essence, and that's proven to be very accurate as an estimate. If you get a bunch of people who have a committed stake to getting things right, and in this case it's money, then you can kind of get more information. So they're using data and they're using the public's gut feel or whatever people use to bet.
Well, I found it pretty surprising after looking at the numbers. For example, Amanda found that teams with shorter players were more successful. That was a shocker.
Yeah, that's an example of one of those things that the machine learning algorithms are really good at finding, and it's all about trying to find counterintuitive things if you're in one of these competitions against other people, because if you think about it, the other people that you're competing against, they have the same data as you, they have kind of the same principles as you in terms of trying to find the best predictive things. So sometimes you have to go sort of off the reservation and try to find something that's predictive, as long as it's supported by the data and by historical precedent. You know, in March Madness, protecting the ball is very important, and having dynamic point guards is very important. So the data might be picking that up as a proxy for this point guard effect, and that's why it shows up as if your team is shorter, then you have a better chance of winning, all other things being controlled for.
Well, you're the numbers guy. Is it possible, or has anyone ever picked a perfect bracket?
The odds of a perfect bracket are very low. I think it's 1 in 4 trillion, and that's if you use a model like we have here at 538, which just tries to take into account all of the different power ratings, and we give probabilistic picks for each game. So if you picked our favorite in every single game, and then you played the bracket out, you'd have to have 4 trillion tries at it to get one perfect bracket. And if you did coin flips on every single game, I think the number comes out to 1 in 9.2 quintillion. I don't actually even know how many zeros that is, but it gets pretty astronomically improbable, which is why Warren Buffett, when he offered the $1 billion to anyone that could fill out a perfect bracket, I think he probably slept pretty soundly that night. He wasn't too worried about someone winning that money.
All right. How about you, Neil? Looking at the 3 approaches, which one of these would you bet on?
You know, I feel in a lot of cases that Vegas is the best predictor. Although I have a huge amount of respect for the other two, you know, there's a reason why people usually, when they play against the house usually wins. And it's because it's so difficult to beat Vegas and out-predict their models that they have.
Neil Payne, senior sports writer for 538.com. Thank you.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You can find a link to watch the very short and delightful video Breaking the Bracket from 538.com and Fictionless. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You'll find them at the bank, at the grocery store, or endure them, certainly, at the DMV. Maybe you stood online to get your new iPhone or to snag a pair of hot concert tickets when you were a teenager. You've been standing in lines your whole life. And yet, the history of this incredibly boring, seemingly ubiquitous activity is a relatively short one, and not as universal as you may think. David Andrews is author of the book, Why Does the Other Line Always Move Faster? It's a sort of historical and cultural and psychological exploration of the queue. And David, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about the origins of the structure of the line. A queue is a French word that actually means tail. And this was first observed in English literature by the Scottish man, Thomas Carlyle, a philosopher and historian, observing the French Revolution. Why there? Why then?
Well, this is actually one of the biggest surprises when researching this book, which is how recent the concept of standing in line is. And so, yeah, Thomas Carlyle was basically writing his history of the French Revolution. And in describing what essentially the bread lines, these queues, and you said it's tail because a line looks like a tail, he had all these rapturous words for this thing that they're doing. And it's the French Revolution, so that, you know, there's lots of calls for fraternity and equality. And the queue was supposed to be a manifestation of we are all equal. In the case of the French peasants waiting for bread, meant they were all equal to be hungry equally. They had to wait for hours every day for bread that might not even show up. So it was really a thing born out of necessity. But Thomas Carlyle, who lived in London when he was writing this and experienced London as this really chaotic place full of crowds and mobs. And he looked at this orderly structure called the queue and had all these rapturous words for this.
So it's a symbol of this new egalitarian society. But yet 19th century American tourists who went to France, as you tell us in the book, were mystified by queues there. So what was it like before?
Well, so the story of line standing in general is the story of people moving into cities. So you read accounts of London in the 19th century or New York or Paris, and it's full of mobs and crowds. There's no sidewalks to keep traffic apart from pedestrians. There's no centralized design. You know, starting in the 18th century, you start seeing like city grids, for instance, but there wasn't a lot of social control over the crowds. And so line standing was born out of, you know, people going through the military, for instance, and having to stand in line in formation, or getting children off the streets and into schools where they'd all have to stand in line. So it took a while. It took a few generations. But by the end of the 1900s, you start having people complaining about what a dull, relentless thing line standing is. So between like 1850, when American tourists were going over to France, and, you know, what a novelty, and 1900, where it's already become this sort of deadened activity that people mindlessly filter through.
It was in the military, or at least in ROTC training, that you first started really looking at these lines and talked about it with your dad. And your family emigrated from Romania, where there are lines for absolutely everything. Your father refuses to stand online. So was this the beginning of this obsession, I think, with lines for you?
Yeah, I mean, so you mentioned the military, where the big surprise to me was that it's not some action-packed, you know, shooting guns. And it's mainly you just stand in line for a long time every day as you filter through the chow hall or you go get your physical exams, just one line after the other. And they have, like, very strict guidelines for how one waits in line. You wait with your hands at your side, staring straight ahead at the back of the head of the person in front of you, not speaking. And it does give you this, like, a long time to think about what a strange thing this is to stand in line. And the other thing is traveling to Jordan, which had a lack of order in the crowds. And so it made me really wonder if line standing isn't something that's natural, or if it's different in different cultures, how did we come to have our own norms of line standing, and what might the history of that be?
Well, and you observe the way that people wait online in other places. So there's the chaos, the loudest, the most aggressive person served first. So how has the queue tamed us?
We have been tamed by lots of, say, experiences that teach us to really embody the queue. So all of us go through kindergarten, and one of the first lessons of kindergarten is to, you know, wait your turn, stand in line, stop fidgeting. There's lots of ways that people have been disciplined into standing in line. There's also lots of environmental cues, so that, you know, you go into the bank and they have that velvet rope, and you know, like, okay, this is the way that you're supposed to act. And then there's simply few people want to stand out in a crowd. And to push yourself to the front of the line to cut somehow, you realize you're going against the trend of everybody else, and feeling judged by other people really gets people to act as everybody else is acting.
You know it if you're at the DMV or at the supermarket, that waiting online can be torture. But it is a unique feature of modern Western society. It's pretty much a world unto its own. And David Andrews is with us. He's written an entire book about the myths and misery and secrets and psychology of waiting in line. So it's funny. Queuing or lining up is a sort of symbol of civility and living in a society where everybody's equal and waits their turn. But cutting queue brings out a lot of incivility, a lot of simmering rage. So what have you observed about these parallel tracks?
Here's the funny thing about, I don't know, line cutters. I talked to a group actually of middle schoolers recently, and apparently the term now is line budging, which I never heard. But outside of school, outside of like grade school, it's remarkable how little that happens. I don't actually observe it that much in everyday life. And I think it's because most of us have so fully taking on the guilt of cutting in line. Like, we'd feel guilty. There's actually an experiment done by the social psychologist Stanley Milgram. I think it was back in the 70s. He and his grad students would go out and they would basically cut in line to see how people would behave. There are two things that surprised him. One is that, for one thing, surprisingly few people actually complained. You know, maybe they'll give a grimace or roll their eyes or some sort of passive-aggressive gesture. But more often than not, people would just shrug and let it be. The second big surprise was how guilty Stanley Milgram and his graduate students felt. You know, sweaty palm, just, they felt as super wrenching.
Well, there can be a lot of incivility in lines or anger, but also camaraderie. I mean, I've been in many lines, you know, like in a waiting to try on clothes or something, you know, sharing, sort of comparing things with other people in the line, or buying concert tickets. There's a sense of identity that forms when you're all in this together. So when does it go from that sort of, I'm an individual waiting my space, to somehow we're in this together?
Well, first I would note that most of those lines are completely voluntary. This is not the case where you're late for your flight and the TSA slows you down or you have to go through the DMV. So these are usually cases where people choose to join this line for something completely, you know, frivolous is maybe the wrong word, but yeah, it's just completely voluntary. For instance, every couple of months in New York City, for instance, the new trend, the Shake Shack or the Cronuts. You also see this in cases like the new Star Wars films that came out a decade ago or so. And people would wait in line for weeks ahead of time. And what happens in those cases is, yes, this commonality is largely born out of a commonality of purpose, in the sense that all these people are waiting for the same thing. They can talk about those things with other people. There's shared excitement. And after a time, if you wait long enough, you start to be friends with the people in line. You share something in common. You have jokes you can tell. They actually did studies of very long lines, like the 2 weeks long line to get Star Wars tickets a decade ago. And yeah, they'd have these communities form that had their own kind of jerry-rigged rules and laws and ways of negotiating conflict. And yeah, and so they have this deep camaraderie about those sorts of lines.
People do voluntarily line up to go to Disney World and line up for the rides there. There's probably no more American scenario than the kind of constructed world of Disney World, which you call, I think, the global epicenter for standing in line. And this is all controlled centrally by a bunker underground. What's going on here?
Disney World is definitely like the cutting edge of line standing. Everybody goes to Disney World knowing that they're going to have to wait in line, and yet we do it anyways, which means most people don't necessarily experience those lines as terribly onerous. Disney World and Disneyland were from the beginning very aware of how people experience waiting in line and trying to fix that problem. And Disney World has, you know, they actually want people to stand in line, because you don't want everybody just to go through the park in a couple of, you know, 2 hours and then leave. They actually want some kind of delay built into it, but they also don't want people to feel like it's a burden. So they do things like they're monitoring these lines from an underground bunker. They see a line that is getting too long. They might go deploy, say, a Mickey Mouse figure to go greet children or find ways to distract people from the fact that they are waiting. They also have lots of detail within their lines to make it, you know, just to keep people's minds off the fact that they are waiting. People who are designing line standing experiences realize that, yes, it's a problem when people have to wait too long, but what's more onerous is the perception of waiting too long. So Disney has found a lot of ways of distracting people and making sure their expectations are more than met. Even in fact, to the point where Disney, for instance, they'll have like projected wait times that are overinflated, so that, say, it says 45 minutes to get through the line and you get through in 30 minutes, you just feel like there's a much better experience. Like, you know, lucky you that you got to go through the line so quickly.
Well, now that so many people are using smartphones for efficiency and getting a lot of their business done in other ways on the computer, do you think lines are going away?
I think to a large degree, yes. I mean, it's never been easier for me to avoid traffic than it is right now. There's no reason that for most things I even have to leave my house. You know, I can you know, press a button and in 2 hours Amazon will deliver what I need to my door. But even, you know, traffic, for instance, is another kind of a form of line standing. Now I have, you know, I do Google Maps and they'll tell me, oh, this is backed up right here. You might need to take another route. And so having more information and more options really lessens the likelihood that you will stand in line. Of course, I don't think it's going to go away completely. I think everybody will have to go through these bottlenecks. Everybody will have to do, you know, go through kindergarten through 12th grade. They'll have to occasionally stand in a TSA line. But those bottlenecks are disappearing so that with more information, we can all choose to, we can all choose paths, basically, that are going to avoid the time we wait in line.
David Andrews, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
David Andrews, he's author of Why Does the Other Line Always Move Faster? It's his new book, and there's more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Let's be honest, when you hear the term patent law, you probably don't perk up with sudden interest. But how about patent war? Our next story about an epic legal battle between two huge companies, and no, we're not talking about Apple versus Android, was produced by Audrey Quinn for the podcast Life of the Law.
Velcro closure, just like the Huggies did.
Think about the parts of a disposable diaper for a minute. You've got the sturdy fabric outside, you've got the puffy fabric on the inside, maybe some sticky tabs to hold it all together. Doesn't seem like rocket science. But watch a few diaper videos on YouTube and you'll realize things are more complicated.
I know a lot of people prefer Huggies, but I prefer Pampers, and I'll tell you why now. First, let me show you.
Hours and hours of parents staring into their computer screens, arguing the merits of Huggies versus Pampers.
I'm telling you, I am so, so very upset with Pampers.
If you want to save some money, then I guess go with Huggies. But if you don't want to clean up messes...
just to let all of you know, Pampers are so much better for newborns. And
what gets me about these videos is that they're so different from other YouTube brand debates. Sure, there are even more videos about McDonald's versus Burger King, or Coke versus Pepsi. But no one pleads so earnestly into the camera while explaining why one brand's French fries taste better than others. No one pauses mid-sentence to soothe their crying baby or explain why their wife's not around, while boasting about their favorite soda.
It has a side elastic and a side flap.
If you're a parent, diapers are the only thing that stands between your baby's bowel movements and, well, everything you own. You'll probably spend at least $1,000 on them, per kid. All around the world, that's about $40 billion spent a year on diapers. And diaper companies know this. The makers of Huggies and Pampers, the two biggest brands, they want those dollars. And they don't want to have to compete with each other to get them. Which is why, in the 1980s and 90s, they tried to litigate each other out of existence. In a patent battle known as the Diaper Wars.
It's a 150-year-old term to refer to these things as wars.
Adam Mossoff's a professor of law at George Mason University School of Law. He's also a patent historian. He says today we talk a lot about the smartphone wars, the battle between Apple and Android. But that's just the latest.
In fact, there was a patent war over the telephone, over electrical distribution systems, over radio, over airplanes, over television, over the laser. The diaper wars is another one that I mentioned.
Mossoff says the diaper wars show that even products we take for granted involve massive technological innovation, innovation that companies are willing to spend millions to defend. To do it, they use a legal framework that's barely changed for centuries, patent laws. Diapers might seem like an odd source of a patent battle, like what kind of technology are we talking about here? But remember those earnest parents?
The last feature that Pampers has...
They need their diapers to work. and the way they work is through some surprisingly complicated technology. Back in the 1960s, Procter & Gamble, the maker of Pampers, pretty much owned the disposable diaper market.
Where are you off to?
Oh, I'll be back. I just have to put Kenny's diapers to soak.
You still washing diapers?
Well, they don't wash themselves.
We use Pampers.
I watched about a dozen of these black and white ads, and it was clear. Diapers automatically meant this lousy cloth thing, and Pampers were just synonymous with the disposable version. Which they were. Like how the brand name Polaroid just automatically means instant camera. For nearly two decades, if you were a North American parent burnt out on washing poo-covered pieces of cloth, you probably went out and bought Pampers. Until Huggies came along.
My recollection is in the early 80s, Kimberly Clark came on the scene in a fairly big way with the Huggies product. I'm John Sweeney. I'm a patent attorney.
Sweeney represented Procter & Gamble, the big guys in the diaper wars.
And Huggies was sort of the number two firm, but gaining market share on Procter & Gamble. My name is Bill Baumgartner, and I was one of the lawyers for Kimberly Clark.
You're going to hear a lot about these two companies and their two brands, so here's a trick. Pampers. The brand that starts with a P comes from Procter & Gamble, the company that starts with a P. Huggies come from Kimberly Clark. Maybe Procter & Gamble could have tried to just out-advertise Kimberly Clark when Huggies came along, get the better of them that way. But remember, Procter & Gamble thinks Pampers are disposable diapers. So if Kimberly Clark's now selling a disposable diaper, Huggies, the assumption was they were using their Pampers technology to steal Pampers customers. And Procter & Gamble had patents on that technology. So Procter & Gamble took Kimberly Clark to court to charge them with patent infringement, one diaper patent at a time. And Kimberly Clark responded in pretty much the same way.
Well, it was Procter & Gamble and Kimberly Clark going at each other to get their piece of the pie in the disposable diaper market. My name is David Allen, and I am a patent lawyer who represented Kimberly Clark in the diaper wars.
If you didn't catch that Ottawa accent, Aileen was actually on the Canadian Council for Kimberly Clark. This was an international undertaking. But he sat in on the American trials too. And every single diaper patent was fair game for litigation. Up first in 1985, elastic waistbands. This ad aired about a year before the first trial.
It's the diaper game, and we're here with our current champion. The first question, who has new elastic waistbands? Right, Huggies diapers.
Procter & Gamble was saying to Kimberly Clark, you can't boast about Huggies' great elastic waistbands. That was our invention. You have no right to it. The case went before a jury.
Yeah, that's just like Perry Mason.
I counted about five lawyers on each side managing this case.
These are Kimberly Clark lawyers Bill Baumgartner and David Allen again.
And they were all males, with a male judge talking to the jury. And what they were talking about is how diapers work.
How elastic waistbands stop pee leakage. How important this is to parents.
It was a pretty amusing situation.
But not a trivial one. Kimberly Clark was afraid their Huggies diapers would go the way of the Kodak instant camera. There's a reason we call instant cameras Polaroids. Kodak, the number two brand in the instant camera market, didn't make it. They lost to Polaroid in a patent infringement case. And in the diaper wars, there was a chance here that if Procter & Gamble won, they'd go back to being the only big dog in the fight. Pampers would mean disposable diaper forever. Here's Kimberly Clark lawyer Bill Baumgartner.
Well, we were staying at the same hotel, and the Procter & Gamble lawyers went out to dinner in a limousine every night. We usually had takeout food in our office.
But they got the last laugh. The jury ruled that Procter & Gamble did not, in fact, have sole rights to the elastic waistband patent.
After the jury verdict, we rode to the airport in their limousine.
But Procter & Gamble just came back with another patent infringement case.
This was their business strategy to use patent litigation to try to drive Kimberly Clark out of the business. And so they failed the first time, and they were going to try again.
And the war went on from there. To understand how things got here, to this multi-million-dollar argument over the containment of baby waste, it helps to understand a little more about patent litigation.
Usually what's most interesting about these cases is that the litigation is not usually about just the specifics of the technology itself.
That's patent historian Adam Mossoff again. The first patent law we know of was in 15th century Venice. Before patents, inventors had to be super stealthy, otherwise people could just steal their ideas and make money off them. Patents helped protect their inventions, so they could share them publicly without fear of getting scooped. But the role of patents changed in the 1850s, thanks to the sewing machine wars. Isaac Singer was selling the first really practical commercial sewing machine, a total hit, and he had come up with a few key features, but a good part of his sewing machine's design piggybacked off of other people's inventions.
Things like having a sewing machine on a horizontal table as opposed to placing it vertically, which is what some of the early sewing machines were designed to do.
Mossoff again.
Having the combination of a needle with a second shuttle carrying a second thread to create what's called a lock stitch. Things that we look at today and say, oh, well, of course.
Other sewing machine makers went after Singer with patent infringement suits. No one was saying they owned all the rights to sewing machine technology. They were just attacking Singer, and later each other, one patent at a time, trying the death by a thousand cuts approach to try to bring down their rivals. This really opened the door for the use of patents as tools of competition. When all else fails, companies cry patent infringement to try to stay at the top of a market. Back in the diaper wars, by now it's 1990, 5 years into the war.
The problem of BM leakage had increased in importance because doctors were placing a new emphasis on breastfeeding, and breastfed babies apparently tend to have explosive runny BMs.
That's Procter & Gamble lawyer John Sweeney reading one of the court documents. This particular trial concerned protection against these explosive runny BMs. Both companies were putting in a new kind of diaper crotch barrier. Here's Pampers advertising theirs.
These new Ultra Pampers have two extra leak barriers to help stop the wet leaks and block the messy leaks.
Kimberly-Clark argued they had patented the special diaper crotch first with their Huggies diapers.
So we had our expert perform what is called an inclined plane test.
That's Procter & Gamble lawyer John Sweeney again.
Where the fabric would be put on an inclined plane at, I think, about 30 degrees or 45 degrees. And then we would allow synthetic urine to hit the material and see if it penetrated the fabric or whether it all rolled off.
This was a urine demonstration for a court.
Well, they wouldn't use those words. They tried to use more metaphorical terms.
This is Kimberly-Clark lawyer David Aylin.
And they would say, like, insulting the diaper or...
Insulting the diaper?
Yes.
And the cases went on from there. For every case tried in the U.S., there was also a Canadian trial, sometimes also a Mexican trial. Dozens more lawyers talking euphemistically about urine. The diaper wars finally came to an end in 1992. The company settled an antitrust case out of court. In the meantime, though, off-brands had sprung up, using the leading brand's technology. So when Kimberly-Clark and Procter & Gamble stopped fighting each other, they got to work litigating the other guys out of business. The top generic brand went into bankruptcy 6 years later. And today, Kimberly-Clark and Procter & Gamble are still at the top of the disposable diaper market. Was it worth it? I sat down with Adam Mossoff, the patent historian, to talk about that. I met him in his office, which was complete with a life-size Captain Kirk cutout and a growing collection of Supreme Court Justice bobblehead dolls.
I'm a geek. I admit it. In fact, in a certain sense, you have to be a geek to do what I do in patent law.
Mossoff says at the end of the day, he thinks it was the consumers that won the diaper wars.
You know why?
That sounds too easy.
Why does that sound too easy? Because that's typically who always wins the wars.
But to enjoy these benefits, we foot the bill for sometimes decades of litigation. And Mossoff says that's just part of the cost of innovation. Ultimately, we, the consumers, are the ones getting the better sewing machine, the better smartphone, the better diaper.
We end up actually paying less for the products and services that come from the new technology, even in paying in those products and services for the various costs that go into making them. Lawyers are part of this process throughout everything. In fact, it's somewhat of an unfortunate assumption that people think of lawyers or other types of costs of getting something as completely unnecessary.
Yeah, that makes me think that I'm okay with the price I'm paying for a product going towards R&D, but the idea of the price I'm paying for a product also contributing to the company's legal fees for some reason doesn't sit as well with me.
But they're very much intertwined with each other. A company is not going to spend billions of dollars in research and development if they don't have also the ability to say to other companies in the marketplace or other individuals, you have to pay me to use my property.
Just for a lark, I asked some parents how they've seen disposable diapers progress at a Target store in Brooklyn, and the reactions were mixed. Donald Cummings was buying diapers for his grandchild, his daughter's baby.
Do they look different from when she was a baby?
Looks the same weight like to me. I can't really tell much difference in it.
But Nicole Peterkin sees a clear improvement.
Yeah, definitely.
How so?
More absorbent. They're more absorbent than what they used to be.
Lorraine Lambert says she really just cares how they work now. And she says diapers these days, they still leak. But she figures gradual improvement is just a given for any technology. Take computers.
Yeah, some technology is still, you know, crashing. Some of them still get viruses. So it's going to take some time.
And maybe even more than just time, it's going to take some more patent battles. John Sweeney, the lawyer who represented Procter & Gamble in the diaper wars, actually still represents the company today. I asked him if this could happen again. Could we get diaper wars 2.0?
I think it's possible.
By which he means he might have a case.
So there's one I'm working on now, but I can't disclose the name of the other party, I'm sorry to say. From the lawyer's perspective, of course, we're hoping it turns into a very intense, another 5-year war or something, but I don't know if the companies really want to do that.
For Life of the Law, I'm Audrey Quinn.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you're looking for something to do in Connecticut, you could make a stop at the world capital of Witch Hazel near Watertown. Head a couple of hours north and you might find yourself in the world capital of earmuffs, Farmington, Maine. South, you'll hit Havre de Grace, Maryland, world capital of decoy ducks. Maybe you're looking for a nose job. Well, Tehran is the place to go. These are just a few examples of the weird and maybe surprising capitals scattered around the globe and gathered by George Pendle for Atlas Obscura. George, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So how are these capitals decided? Do they have to earn them or just declare them?
Well, I guess it's a mixture. You could say, you know, some are born to greatness, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them. And if you think of a capital like the capital of lightning in the world, which is Catatumbo in Venezuela, that has something like 280 lightning strikes per hour. Of course, that's going to be the lightning capital of the world. We're told that lightning doesn't strike the same place twice, but it does in Catatumbo. So that's kind of, you know, a capital which is born to its kind of title. You have other ones which achieve greatness through, like, you know, massive manufacturing. You mentioned a few of them to start off with, but somewhere like Strong, Maine, which was the toothpick capital of the world, produced something like 75 billion toothpicks a year. And when you just have numbers like that, it's kind of unstoppable. I mean, why would you not call it the toothpick capital of the world? And then you have some which are kind of thrust, you know, upon them. I mean, these are kind of capital cities which don't claim these titles themselves, but due to the predominance of something happening there, they're called it by the media. For instance, Alice Springs in Australia is the stabbing capital of the world, and there's no way they put that in their tourist literature. This is something which has just occurred and various people have written about, just because it's so odd that so many stabbings should take place in such a small town. But so those are the three kind of paths to being a world capital.
And some discovered by others, like Ottawa, capital of infidelity.
That's right.
How did it earn that?
Yes, apparently that came from when the Ashley Madison website was hacked into. That was the website which was all about having affairs. If you're a married person, you could have an incognito affair. But unfortunately, when hackers hacked into it, they found out that Ottawa was actually the place in the world with the most members of their site. So that was rather unfortunate.
Well, there's an interesting history of towns that declare themselves to be the world capital of you name it. How did it become so popular, especially here in the U.S.?
Well, it seems to have been very much a kind of a 1950s, 1930s, early 20th century kind of trope. especially in the United States. I mean, it was when the United States was really kind of starting to flex its muscle across the world. And I think New York or D.C. would have been seen as the world capital. That was where all the money was coming in. That was where the commerce was. That was where the military was. And so I think all these other cities and towns thought, well, hey, we're capitals too. We're creating all the stuff that the world needs. So why not call ourselves the world capital? I think I refer to it somewhere as a kind of manifest destiny of things.
Hmm.
It was when the United States was this kind of manufacturing powerhouse and had, you know, really was the capital of so much that the rest of the world consumed. And so it became this 20th century trope, yet it's kind of spread. I mean, now if you look to China, many of the cities there which have taken over the manufacturing jobs call themselves the capital city of that, the capital city of jeans, you know, which used to be in America is now in China. Or, you know,
and zippers, I noticed, in Japan.
Zippers in Japan, indeed. Kurobe City in Japan is the place host to the YKK company, which if you look down at your zipper, you will probably see YKK written on your zipper. And that is because that company makes, something like 80 to 90% of all the zippers in the world. And so, you know, they took something which had been innovated in America, in Pennsylvania, in fact, in a town called Meadville. The Talon Zipper Company used to be the world, you know, it used to be the world capital of zippers in Pennsylvania. But then slowly, Japan and Kurobe City took over. They managed to make the zippers better and cheaper. And so they kind of became the new capital. It's a bit like, you have to think of this as a bit like Game of Thrones. You know, there are always new cities trying to take away the title from somebody else.
Well, you do have the capital sorted into reigning, wavering, toppled, and contested. Many of the toppled ones are former manufacturing homes, like Newton, Iowa, said to have been the washing machine capital until Maytag closed its plant there in 2007. Kind of sad, isn't it?
It is kind of sad, but I guess it's like evolution. These things ebb and flow. I mean, and sometimes, you know, old manufacturing towns create new things out of the ashes of the old manufacturing industry. I mean, if you were to look at a place like I'm going to pronounce this wrongly, but Leominster in Massachusetts, I think it's Leominster.
Leominster.
But you look at that, and that's, you know, that back in the 18th century was the comb capital of the world. Now, that may seem obscure and bizarre, but in the 18th and 19th centuries, combs were essential. You didn't have shampoo. You didn't have all the sorts of hair products we have now. And having a comb was really the only way of keeping your head clean. Now, this was the capital for years, you know, for a century, until something terrible happened around 1914. A very famous ballroom dancer and film star, Irene Castle, she cut her hair into what is now known as the bob. And with that, suddenly thousands, millions of people started cutting their hair short, and the need for combs was no longer quite as great. So Leominster's comb industry just plummeted at that point. Fortunately, however, they managed to diversify. They had started making plastic combs by that point, and they realized that instead of making combs, they could just make all sorts of plastic junk. Basically, the plastic kitsch, which we know and love, such as plastic pink flamingos on the lawns that you see, they began to make it, and they've become this kind of plastic kitsch capital of the world. And that all came out of the fact that they used to make combs. So there's hope, even where everything seems ruined.
All right, George, you've looked at a number of capitals. Any favorites, like anything really come to mind as a great surprise for you?
Oh, well, gosh, I don't know. I have some favorites. I mean, there's one which I'm writing about at the moment, which is a Chinese city called Guarao, which has actually named itself the capital of sexy because it's the largest manufacturer of bras and lingerie in the world. But rather than naming it that, it just decided to claim itself as the capital of sexy. So I'm quite fond of that, even though I think the town itself is rather polluted and not a very sexy place to be.
Well, George Pendle, what fun talking with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
George Pendle, he's an author and a journalist, and you can find his article with an interactive map of 90 of the world's strangest capitals at Atlas Obscura. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Really glad that you took some time to listen today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org or the Word of Mouth podcast, which you can find by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. I'm Virginia Prescott. Back tomorrow, too, here on NHPR.